White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me on The Heretics Hour for Monday, July 2nd, 2012. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. Tonight, I have a program about Holocaust. Some of it is humorous, some of it is rather disgusting, and some of it is quite serious, in my estimation. Well, Holocaust is always serious, or it should be, for those of us who are accused of perpetrating it. And if you are a white European person, you should realize that you are accused of perpetrating it. In the second hour of tonight's program, the well-known revisionist Friedrich Paul Berg, otherwise known as Fritz Berg, whose long-running website is www.nazigassings.com, will join me to talk about the serious part, like how to keep Holocaust revisionism alive. That's pretty serious, I think. And I'll remind you that Mr. Berg will answer questions that you can email to me during the program. Send them to carolyn@carolynyeager.com. You can send them just any time now, but I won't be looking at them until later. In this first hour, I have a slew of items I would like to cover, the most prominent of which is the Miss Holocaust Survivor Beauty Pageant that just concluded. Most of you have already read about that, I'm sure, looked at the photographs and gotten a good laugh from it, but there's more to say about this bizarre phenomenon. The question I ask is, how could it come to this? Where would such an idea come from? Well, it's about the cult of the survivor. And this is a very important aspect of the world we live in today, which some call the Holocaust religion. And we'll talk about that more in the second half. But the cult of the survivor is something that is really growing. And it is bizarre. And it ends up with something like this pageant for Holocaust survivors. Now, according to the Jewish figuring on this, or the Holocaust industry, say, every Jew who was in the German-occupied areas of Europe, including Russia, you know, everywhere, is considered by the Jewish organizations who are allowed to decide this question to be a Holocaust survivor. You didn't have to particularly suffer all the things that most people associate with Holocaust survivors. You only had to be a Jew who was under a threat, whether anything actually materialized or not. Now, Alan Dershowitz believes, I think most of you know who he is, so I won't bother to explain it. He believes that all American Jews should think of themselves as victims of the Holocaust. At least he has said this. His rationale is that they were ultimately targets of the Holocaust. So this is how this idea, you know, keeps spreading out and taking in more and more Jews. Like every Jew in the world can be considered a victim of the Holocaust, and every white European descended person can be considered a perpetrator of the Holocaust. But what does this mean? That they were ultimately targets of the Holocaust. I mean, I really had to ask myself that. I think it means that they would eventually have been killed by the Germans, according to the German plan to rid the world of every Jew. This is the Jewish mantra that they continue to repeat, and it actually has grown from what it used to be. But so now, you know, every Jew, no matter where they were, can be considered a victim, a Holocaust victim, with this idea. Now, thinking about that, I think that you could make a case for World War II survivors, saying that everyone who was alive and living in a war zone anytime during World War II is a World War II survivor. Why not? Surviving World War II wasn't such an easy thing either, especially not just for the people fighting in it, but for the civilians. And so I say it's the same thing, really. World War II in itself was a pretty horrific and scary event. And for some people, it was a lot more scary than for others. But every German would be a World War II survivor and have special status over those of us who weren't, because some of us cannot claim that, but an awful lot of people in the older age range now can certainly claim that. Why don't we claim some of these special privileges for ourselves? Anyway, I'm going to introduce this pageant. I'm going to lead into this Miss Holocaust Survivor pageant by reminding you that this is not the first tasteless idea playing up and using sympathy for Holo survivors. There was a Holo survivor cookbook. It was called Holocaust Survivor Cookbook. It was recipes, it says, collected from around the world. Anyway, the description is, it was, and this came out not too long ago, but a while ago. I mean, it's not just last month or probably even this year or maybe a few years ago. But, and I don't have the date of it, sorry. But it's called the Holocaust Survivor Cookbook. And it was put together by the daughter of a Holocaust survivor and her husband, Jonathan. So the two of them did it together. So it was probably what they decided to do for a living and maybe make their little fortune this way if it really took off. And they were new immigrants to Israel from the USA. So they left the US and went to Israel. And this woman's mother, was a Holocaust survivor. And she collected 100 stories from Holocaust survivors from many countries all over the world, including like Argentina, Australia, China, England, Sweden, and the United States. So she starts out with the stories and then says that most of the women who submitted recipes in the book are Holocaust survivors. Most, not all, most. So she had to supplement some other recipes, obviously. And it says, it appears that the book just has normal recipes in it for the most part, like bread, soups, salads, main dishes, but it also includes some Passover recipes. And accompanying the recipes are photographs of happy families before the, you know, happy Jewish families before the Holocaust. And, then of those, also photographs of those who survived and rebuilt their lives and started their own families and so on. So this is the story about this book. And now we shouldn't be really all that surprised, although it's strange that we have a Miss Holocaust Survivor beauty pageant. And some people say, well, it wasn't a beauty pageant, but it was. It was a beauty pageant. That was a big part of it. And I'll bring that out as we go on. Anyway, the pageant started on June 28, 2012, and I think so it wasn't all that long ago, you know, within the past week. And during the pageant, 20 women competed. They are between 74 and 90 years old. Anyway, I'm going to give some highlights here from the article about it. The women, 14 women were the finalists, and they were paraded Thursday in an unusual, they were paraded, you know, in a special dinner and, in a kind of a place where people a big place where people, nightclub type place, not really a nightclub, but a big meeting place. And they had a big dinner and some other things. And they paraded on the stage and, for the honor of being crowned Miss Holocaust Survivor. The pageant organizer was Shimon Sebag, and he said he rejected criticism of what he had done. He said the winners were chosen based on their personal stories of survival and rebuilding their lives after the war, and physical beauty was only a tiny part of the competition. Well, you know, they say that about all beauty contests now, all beauty pageants, don't they? When they started being criticized and probably maybe in the 80s, certainly in the 90s, that they were silly and it shouldn't exist. So they said, well, they're not about looks. They're not about parading you in a bathing suit. They're about personality and achievement. So that's how they're talking about this one the same way, even though the others are very much about the looks of the contestants. Now nearly 300 women from across Israel registered for the competition. So think of all these women from in their 70s 80s and 90s who wanted to win this. They wanted to be a part of it. That's quite a large number, actually, from that age range. And they had to whittle the contestants down to the 14 finalists. And it says that 600 people attended the lavish dinner. Here's where it tells about this. A lavish dinner and music at a Haifa reception hall. Did I say that this took place in Haifa, Israel? And of the 600 people who attended, it included two cabinet ministers, Moshe Kalon and Yossi Peled, who himself is a Holocaust survivor, naturally. The women, as I said before, ranged in age from 74 to 97. They at one point they wore black dresses, earrings and necklaces in their numbered sashes, which were blue and white, naturally blue on white, and they were shown to the, you know, paraded by in front of the audience, and the music played. They walked along a red carpet. And they introduced themselves and described their memories of World War II. Now, these are pretty good. This one lady, Esther Liber, who was 74 years old, who was a runner-up but not the winner, said, quote, "I have the privilege to show the world that Hitler wanted to exterminate us, and we are alive. We are also enjoying life. Thank God it's that way." Now, her story is that she fled her home in Poland as a child, hid in a forest, and was rescued by a Polish woman. She said she lost her entire immediate family. Oh, that sounds so familiar. Now, I think about her story. I wonder how it works. I don't know if she could explain it any better than what she said, and nobody's asked her probably. But so as a child, she lived in Poland. And then she hid in a forest, okay? She must have gone into the forest with her family, with her parents. She didn't go in there by herself. But she was rescued by a Polish woman. No mention of how or what happened to the rest of her family, except that she said she lost all of them. So when she lost them and how she ended up being rescued is, we don't know. We hear things like that so often. And I think that's why she would never have won, because if she was the winner, she might have to say more about her personal story and explain it better, and probably they know she maybe couldn't do that. It would all come apart. So, continuing on, the winner was, the finalists and the winner were chosen by a 4-judge panel consisting of 3 former beauty queens and a geriatric psychiatrist who specializes in treating Holocaust survivors. Now, here you say it's not a beauty contest, really. It's more serious than that, but the panel is 3 former beauty queens. And then this psychiatrist who specializes in treating Holocaust survivors for obviously psychiatric disorders. And I would think that he's probably saying that any one of them that want to be have psychiatric problems, if not all of them, so that they can claim extra benefits from the benefactors, the Germans, and then there's some others too. And certainly they don't get them from Israel, although Israel says that they've had to give some money to to do some support for their survivors, and they resent it very much. They want to get that money back from Germany or anywhere they can. Now, the winner was Hava Hershkovitz. She's going on 79, and her story is that she was banished from her home in Romania in 1941 and sent to a detention camp in the Soviet Union for 3 years, and that's it. Now, it's interesting that the word detention camp is used, not a concentration camp. So the first thing that comes to my mind is that they were removing Jews from Romania because Romania was an ally to Germany. And in 41, you know, they started the war against, they invaded Russia, and Romania was fully involved in fighting on the German side, or which is to say the Axis side. And so the Jews were considered security threats, which actually they were, and they were removed out into these special camps. Now, you know, the United States had all kinds of detention camps where they kept secure, what they considered security threats, Japanese, German, and Italian people. And for the Japanese and Italians, they mostly were not citizens. Some were U.S. citizens, but mostly they were nationals who had come, who had emigrated, but had never gotten around to changing their citizenship. So, but for the Japanese, whether they were citizens or not, they interned them all. And that was, you know, many thousands. I don't really know the number, but it was a lot more than the other two. But all of it was, they were all in these detention facilities for many years. It really screwed up their lives, but they don't get this kind of attention that these Jews over there get. So Hava Hershkovitz, the winner, said, quoting her, says, "This place is full of survivors. It puts us at the center of attention so people will care. It's not easy at this age to be in a beauty contest, but we're all doing it to show that we're still here." Well, they're still here, all right. You know how many of them are still here? 200, no, what's this number? Let me go down here so I don't get it wrong. Yeah, 200,000, supposedly, that's what they say, 200,000 aging survivors in Israel alone. And that's an awful lot, almost 70 years after they were all released and, you know, liberated and so on. And all these people who are survivors now were children at the time. So 200,000 children who weren't murdered just in Israel. And there's more, I think there's more survivors in the United States than in Israel. I can't be quoted on that, but I think so. There's an awful lot, and then there's they're all over the world, really. But the probably the largest number is in the United States, and after that, Israel. So there's huge number of survivors all over the world still. She says, we want people to know we're here. Well, good, you know, good. We should know that they're here. How many of them there are? So going on down here, this is interesting. It was a cosmetics company that was recruited to help the women dress up for the occasion. I think the cosmetics company might have had something to do with the organizing the thing or the idea of the thing. Or maybe it was these other people, and then they got in touch with. At least I think the cosmetics company helped pay for it or support it or whatever, because they got a lot of publicity from it. And if, when you see the pictures of these women, these aging women, they have a lot of makeup on. That's one thing that I noticed. They look really silly. They wouldn't look so silly if they didn't have all that makeup on their faces. Well, that's the cosmetic company that did that. And the guy who organized it, Sabag, said, "We always tell them to dress well and look good. We always." I don't know if he's always dealing with these people or not. He says, "To think positive and take care of themselves. Always look at life with a smile and continue to live." Well, oh my. Now there's a Holocaust survivors umbrella group called Avital that criticized the cosmetics company, saying it was using Holocaust survivors in a cheap marketing stunt to promote their products. Well, I say, why not engage in a cheap marketing stunt? Because the entire Holocaust industry, including the movie industry, is a cheap marketing stunt. There's so many cheap marketing stunts going on, Holocaust related, that you can't really single out this one as being certainly not the only one, or even maybe the worst one. Now, I mentioned the 200,000 that are in Israel today still. And here's another thing is that they say, well, this pageant has precedence. You know, it's not so unusual. There have been many unconventional beauty pageants. There's such, for example, there was Miss Landmine contest for survivors of landmine explosions in Angola and Cambodia. Then there, but that's a little more serious, but there's some more lighthearted ones like that they mentioned in the article. Star Trek fans enjoyed the Miss Klingon Empire contest in Atlanta, And then there's the plus-sized women in Thailand who compete for the honor of Miss Jumbo Queen. And so there are also senior citizen pageants in the United States. So, you know, this is on the level. They're saying this. They're putting this contest on the level with these silly affairs. And so I say, you know, they're always complaining about trivializing the Holocaust. I bet Elie Wiesel will not say a word about this. I bet he's cringing over this beauty pageant, because he's always complaining about trivializing the Holocaust. And so are so many others. Who are all those people who do that? There's a bunch of well-known ones. And what could be more trivial than this? So this is really trivializing the Holocaust, which is what makes it pretty funny. And the last sentence in this article says, those who are criticizing that I just mentioned don't really like what they did here. They say Holocaust survivors should be above all this. Well, you know what? They're not. You know, Holocaust survivors are not above much of anything. Holocaust survivors are some of the most greedy, grubby, lying bunch of people. And this really shows, this is so appropriate, what they've done here. And most Holocaust revisionists are just in glee over this whole beauty pageant. But here's, leaving that now, I want to talk about something that Giuseppe Furioso wrote in response to this. And he sent it to a discussion group that I'm on. And I did actually ask him to be on tonight's program to talk about this with me. And he, though, doesn't have Skype and doesn't know how to get it, doesn't want to. So he couldn't be on, although he would have enjoyed being on. But anyway, he didn't want to try to jump over that hurdle. So I am giving it in his place, but I want to make sure that you know these ideas are from Giuseppe Furioso, who's been a revisionist for many years. He used to do a lot more, write a lot more than he does now. We don't hear too much from him, but he's still strongly on our side. So he says, he mentioned a Holocaust cookbook, but it has a different title, In Memory's Kitchen. So there's more than one Holocaust cookbook. Now, here's his first idea. I call these ideas for more Holocaust entertainment, you know, as we've already been entertained by the beauty pageant. He says, how about a Holocaust theme park patterned after Disneyland, complete with fake gas chambers, lampshades, bars of soap, etc.? And I think, well, that's a great idea. How much more trivializing can you get? But actually, what this brings to my mind is that Holocaust museums are close to this already. I have not actually been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., the major U.S. one. But I have seen some pictures from the interior, and they try to give the visitors a feel of somehow being in a concentration camp. They're already doing this. They're already giving people that experience vicariously. So that's a good one. That's his number one. Number two is a Holocaust board game. No, number two, sorry, is Holocaust trading cards, with the gas chamber card being the one most difficult to find. And then he puts in parentheses, some would argue that it may not really exist. Why? Because, well, the way I envision this, you have a set of trading cards of Holocaust, you know, themes, and maybe only one gas chamber card, kind of like the Joker or something in a regular deck of cards. And it's special. It's hard. And maybe you have more than one of the other cards. Maybe some cards you have five or six, and other cards you only have two, but the gas chamber card you only have one. So it's difficult to find. And maybe some people would say, well, we're searching for this gas chamber, but can't find it. Maybe it doesn't exist. All right, number three is the Holocaust board game. The first word, name of it, that comes to my mind is Holopoly. And actually, I think maybe there has already been invented a Holocaust board game. Not by the Holocaust people, but by people kind of making, you know, making a little bit of fun of it. So, I came up with the title, Holopoly, based on Monopoly, or maybe Show a Board Business. That one's a little more far-fetched, but, as best I could do. Anyway, going on to the next one, a Holocaust fashion show with high-end clothing that resembles the garb worn by inmates. I think that's a very good idea, really. That would be funny. You'd get these good, designers, high-level designers, and they could design, real fashionable, avant-garde outfits, based on some kind of, you know, in some way based on inmate clothing. That would be quite a riot, really, it would be. Now he goes to television programs, Dancing with the Holocaust Survivors. You know, instead of Dancing with the Stars, which would take place in a mock gas chamber. The judges, of course, would be dressed in SS uniforms. This is very clever. I would really like to see that. I would have to get TV so I could watch these things. That would be a riot. Now, another TV show you could do is Family Feud, but you would pit Holocaust survivors against blacks or Negroes for both trying to get sympathy and cash awards. So they would both be telling their stories and making them out to be as bad and horrible as possible so they can get as much sympathy as possible and also, of course, win the cash prizes. That's another brilliant idea. I'm going to skip one here to go to another TV show, Holocaust Idol. Naturally, probably you're already thinking of that one, a singing competition between Holocaust survivors. Why not? And, you know, I think which Holocaust survivor has the most talent? That's the way you could bill it. Now, he also has a fake Holocaust memoir award for the most brazen and unbelievable story of Holocaust survival. We know we have all these stories, these memoirs, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later in the next half hour. And they are unbelievable, but you would get the award for the most unbelievable, the most far-fetched, the most brazen story, like this woman above in the pageant who was found in the woods and forests in Poland and saved, but the rest of her family was not somehow. I wonder what her book would be like. A couple more, an auction of concentration camp artifacts. Now, you can bet, if there were such a thing, that you would find everything under the sun being shown as a concentration camp artifact, right? People would pull out anything they could find that they could use to say, well, this was, you know, this was found in a camp by so-and-so or somebody, or my great uncle or something. Of course, a natural is the Holocaust Olympics featuring elderly Jews in athletic competitions. and finally, a musical comedy called Final Solution. Yeah, another thing that naturally comes to mind. Now, there was a Springtime for Hitler, a musical comedy, which was a farce, you know, making fun of Hitler. So why not a one making fun of the people who escaped the Final Solution? Or maybe those who didn't. I don't know. This gets a little grotesque. Anyway, that's the end of Giuseppe's list, and I want to thank once again Giuseppe Furioso for this entertaining bit of triviality. I'm going to move on now to some information that I have kind of just discovered, some of it, about Elie Wiesel. He is somebody I have written a lot about. I have my co-sponsored website, Elie Wiesel Cons the World, at www.eliewieseltattoo.com. And right now, I have put this video, my very first video, back on the front page because I learned from the video maker, whose name is Arnswords, he actually made the video. I provided the script and the images, and he made a wonderful video out of it. And he wrote to me just 2 days ago, that, which I just saw today, it is very popular. It's been posted at the Northwest Nationalist site, which is a white, well, a British, what would you call it, right-wing organization in the UK, Northwest Nationalist. They have a nice website. And there it is, right? I went to it. And at there, it has received 2,173 hits since it was put up. And it hasn't been up all that long. And then he told me that it's on my website, on the one I mentioned, EloiseLTattoo.com. It has 1,650 views. He knows that because he gets that from the Vimeo. He gets that information. I didn't know that. I don't have that. I had no idea it had that many. So that's that. But then he says, then it's on YouTube, and I didn't even haven't even put it on YouTube yet because I can't. I have to. I need some help in. I have a YouTube account, but I haven't really tried to do it because I thought I might have trouble, and I've been so busy. So, but somebody else has put it on YouTube. Probably he has. And on YouTube, it's got 6,521 hits. Those are numbers that I have never seen for anything I've done. So I'm really I was amazed and pleased and excited about this because this all adds up to on 2 days ago. At 10,344 views, so that there'll be more than that now, and it'll keep going. Well, that's really great, and I want to thank Aaron's words for the work that he did, and I hope that we can do another one. And you know, he works. He's a wonderful guy, and I want to point out that he's a Christian identity person who, when I was talking on one of Bill Fink's programs, the very first one I did with him, I just got on and he kind of interviewed me, and I was saying then, well, this Elie Wiesel business, I just don't know how to get more people to read about it, to really care about it, you know, all that I've discovered about him, and I said I really should have a video. I mean, that's what people do; they watch videos. Now I see they really do, even more than they listen to radio programs. And he piped up and, said that he would make one. And Bill said, I don't want to give his real name on here. He said he'd make it. I said, okay. So later, so then, you know, I eventually wrote a script and sent it to him and gave him some images. And, then he had a little, it took a while because there, things intervened, but eventually he did get it done. And it's done now, and it's getting a lot of attention. So this is really good news, and he's done it for nothing. I just told him I wanted to send him some money. He says, I don't want any money. He said, I'm just happy to be able to help in this and do it. And he has a lot of talent. And this is the way so many Christian people are. It's why I don't like Christianity being attacked. Okay, now the other thing about Elie Wiesel is Holocaust, I got an article. Sometime back, I got something from a listener named Samantha, and she wanted to send me something, which she did send me something, and she sent me a donation, plus some newspapers, and one of these was a section from the LA Times in 2002, and it's June 26, 2002, if you would want to somehow go back in the LA Times archives and find this. It's on page, let me look here. It's on page E2. It's a story about the persistence of memory and a picture of Elie Wiesel there and also this other Grossensaft who's, here's what it's about. The article tells how if you do an Amazon search of Holocaust, you get 5,000 results. So there's 5,000 books on Holocaust that Amazon has. And for that reason, if the market is saturated, these are all these survivor books, you know, and other type where people are writing about it, you know, and mostly from the pro-Holocaust point of view. So the market is saturated. So there was no way they thought nobody wanted to publish any more Holocaust survivor books. This was probably in the 90s. So the World Jewish Congress launched the Holocaust Survivors Memoirs Project in the year 2000. And Elie Wiesel, who got, you know, they always involve him, and he gets involved in all this survivor stuff. And he got his publisher, Random House, to grant $1 million for this project. $1 million they can get to do a publishing project. That shows who's got the clout and who can get things done. Now, so then they asked for manuscripts, or, you know, and they received over 750 from the United States, Israel, Latin America, Germany, and other places. Most of them were written in English, but not all. Now, the first 12 were released, it says in this article, between 2002 and 2005 under the aegis of, guess what, United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And article tells us that among the usual survival tales, here's some examples of them. One was told by a Jewish woman who was dropped from the 1936 Olympic team. And I just say, oh, boo-hoo, how terrible. That's a Holocaust survivor tragedy, because she was dropped from the Olympic team in Germany. A woman whose mother, another one, a woman whose mother was a German convert to Judaism, who kept her entire family alive. Well, you know, my comment there is, sure she did, because no one was trying to harm them. That's the reason. She was a German woman. She converted to Judaism. She had a family. Nobody in Germany was gonna hurt these people just because she converted to Judaism. So that's a phony thing right there, too. And in a third one, a man who survived Sobibor, falsely called a death camp. You know, Sobibor is really a phony story about how it was a death camp, and somehow a few people survived it, and one was this man wrote this story. So these are three examples of these books. Asked if these books are literary, Wiesel said, "I'm not looking for literary. I'm looking for truth. The literature of the Holocaust is a specific area of literary creation." Okay, it doesn't have to be literature. It doesn't have to be any good. It can be absolutely illiterate, but, you know, it's Holocaust and it's Holocaust survivors. So that's a specific area that is set apart. And I learned that the initial press run for these books, these 12, was it 12 that I say that they published to begin with, was small, between 3,000 and 5,000 copies each. And they're sold, where do you think? At the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Nobody else wants them. But, the Random House, just to be nice or to not be harassed, gave Elie Wiesel, because Elie Wiesel asked, and he's one of their big authors, you know. So they gave $1 million so they could do all this and then sell them at the United States Holocaust Museum and at Judaica stores, whatever those are. I guess what they really mean is Jewish bookstores, and possibly internet outlets like Amazon. Whether they ever got onto Amazon, I don't know. This was the plan, you know, when the article was written. Now, Rosensaft, who is the fellow who's a business person overseeing this, it said at this time in 2002, he envisions an anthology consisting of excerpts from others, not just these first ones, and possibly making all 750 manuscripts available all online to scholars and students. Now, think about this. These are unvetted stories by nobodies saying whatever the heck they want. And they're going to be, if they were put online like that, they say, well, they can be used by scholars and students. Why would scholars and students want to use stuff like this? But this is the Holocaust industry. And Rosensaft says they're doing this because it's our moral obligation. Okay, more on Elie Wiesel. I'll never get to anything else because tonight, because today I came upon the last of his three speeches that he gave this year at Boston University. Every year he gives a series of talks in the springtime at Boston University, and this year he did them. I read about the first one, and I think I might have written something about it, but I just didn't find the others because they really were not advertised. They weren't writing this stuff up anymore, because last year I really wrote about it and made fun of them. And I do suspect that that might be part of the reason, because ever since I started Elie Wiesel Cons the World, Elie Wiesel has gotten a lower and lower profile, and he doesn't make himself available to the public or available to questions or anything, because you know, he's such an idiot, and you can just make a lot of hay over that. So this last of his the whole series was called the Fascination with Jewish Tales. That's what he named it this year. And the last of the third one was Reflections on Good and Evil. And I just want to tell you, I listened to the whole thing, and there's some highlights that I took notes on that I thought were very interesting. One thing he said I found really interesting, he says, humiliation is considered a terrible sin by Jewish tradition. I don't know if he called it Jewish tradition, but, you know, by Jews, equal to murder. To humiliate someone, he says, to us Jews, is equal to murder. And he repeated this several times. Why? Well, I say because they can tell the world that they have been humiliated. They hate to be humiliated. They hate every act that's been done against them by other people that in some way, well, humiliates them, or really just put, you know, says we don't want anything to do with you or whatever. All that, nobody is allowed to do that. You know how this anti-Semitic movement, this opposing anti-Semitism and calling everything anti-Semitism, is so that you can't say anything about any Jew without it meaning something, you know, equal to murder. Really, I mean, that is the truth. And when you get right down to it. And so he actually came out and said that humiliation is equal to murder, so that when, if you, you know, the humiliation that Jews have suffered, they can say, well, this is just, you know, we've been sinned against so much, so much. And of course, if you want to deport them or remove them from power in any way, that would be another form of humiliation, I suppose. Then he brings up the Crusaders, who are those white European Christians. And, you know, for the in the Middle Ages, who went to Jerusalem on these to save the Christian churches or something, or faith or whatever. And he mentions their, quote, religious certainty, unquote. This is really bad in his eyes, that they were intolerant. You know, he says, on their way to Jerusalem in religious ecstasy, they murdered hundreds of Jewish communities simply because they met them on the way. Read the books, he says. You know, he didn't say what books, but, you know, it's like, oh, this is all documented. Then he goes on to say, naturally, you know, this is supposed to be about, this story was about Reflections on Good and Evil. Well, he eventually, naturally, then goes into Nazism. He says, these events, like the Crusades and so on, were surpassed by Nazism, by Hitler's death camps, and he used the phrase, the words political fanaticism, and he added Stalin's gulags now. I guess he's been kind of pressured into that, so he includes Stalin with Hitler. And then he says, hope was misused when Jews were targeted in German-occupied Europe, which he called the final darkness, you know, what the Jews endured. Jews were told, he says, the new laws are for your brethren in the next country, not here. And what he means by that, what he meant by that was, the Jews were fooled. The Jews were misled. They were tricked by telling them that, oh, these laws that we're passing, they're not for you. They're for the other country. And, you know, and this somehow exonerates the Jews because they didn't care what happened to their brethren in the next country. But anyway, he's saying don't blame the Jews for not resisting because they were misled, they were lied to. And the one who's lying is Weasel. Weasel is lying and making things up about this whole story about the Jews being misled and what they were told and so on. Because the Zionists, you know, were a part of all of what happened to the Jews. And then he starts in on anti-Semitism again. Oh, what a threat it is. Oh, anti-Semitism has raised its ugly head again. Oh, whoa. And he makes this all sound very, very important and serious. And there is no problem with there is now a little bit more anti-Semitism because of what these guys, what these people are doing. But anyway, that I thought that was really interesting to hear the kind of stuff he's still saying in his talks. So here's a little story from Berlin that came that I saw and that also has, was sent by I can't think of his first name now. E4, my friend Eberhard Fuhr, a good man who he was one of the people who was in those German those detention United States detention camps for Germans in World War II, and he was picked up when he was 17 years old and with his brother. His parents had already been sent to one, and his youngest brother, and it's quite a story he has. And then he was eventually, they were reunited with them in the camp in Crystal City, and he had to spend like over five years of his young life in detention. It was totally unnecessary and unfair. I won't go on any more about him because this story is important. It's from Berlin. Gideon Eckhaus is the person's name. He is the head of the Israel-based Central Committee for Jews in Austria. Now get that. It's the Central Committee for Jews in Austria, but it's Israel-based. And he has urged the Central European country, he has urged Austria. He doesn't live in Austria, but he's urged Austria to increase its compensation payments to Austrian survivors of the Holocaust. And when they say Austrian survivors, they mean Jews who were living in Austria. You know, they're not Austrian in my estimation. Some of them were not even born in Austria. A lot of them came to Austria. So they're Jews living in Austria, but they're somehow Austrian survivors who have to be sure that they can live well for the rest of their lives on somebody else's dime. Eckhaus said between 12,000 and 14,000 Austrian victims, or again, Jewish people living in Austria at the time, I don't know if they were victims of the Holocaust, across the world, no matter where you live now, if you were in Austria at that time and you're Jewish, you are living in poverty. He said, I can't imagine. A lot of these Austrians are really rich. Austrian Jews are really rich. But he says if they're living in poverty, 12 to 14,000 of them, and they're in need of medical attention and that they frequently cannot afford. So he called on Austria's government, naturally, Austria's government to fill the gaps in compensation. Doesn't ask Israel for anything. And he says, it was unclear at the time of this story that whether the government plans to increase Holocaust survivor payments. They're already paying them, but I hope they don't. This is just spurious stuff that these people keep coming up with, asking for more money. Now the point I'm getting at with this is that as we live in our world and as the Jewish power structure takes over more and more, and people are still inundated with this Holocaust business. And we, you know, we see these examples that I've given here of it being so getting into mainstream things like beauty pageants and things. It's just weird. So if people accept all that, it just becomes more and more normal that it's okay to do all this. And you know, when the Holocaust survivors are gone, they'll have the children of the Holocaust survivors, and they are even working on the grandchildren, because now they find that they have psychological problems, the grandchildren, and it's going to be in their blood forever. So this is an example. I mean, these are examples of what happens to our world by allowing this to grow, to continue and go on and on. It needs to be stopped. And that's what we're going to talk about in the second hour. It needs to be stopped. Well, now I've got about 9 minutes to go in line. I've got quite a few stories left, but I won't get to them all. I knew I wouldn't. Israel's, this is on Pope Pius XII. Yad Vashem has toned down its accusations of the sins of Pope Pius XII, who was the Catholic Pope during World War II, and the Jews are really come out after him because, of course, he didn't do enough. But now, and the Catholic Church, unfortunately, has bowed down to the Jews, and so they do everything they can to try to work this out to please them without absolutely giving up all their dogma and beliefs. So, and they don't want to condemn this Pope, who is a very beloved Pope, and he was one of the best Popes the Church ever had. So they are standing up for him, but not so much because, they want the blessing of the Jews. And so they've been in talks with the Jews. And so, what bothers me is that in all of the rhetoric of the Catholic Church, it is still and will always be now, I guess, focused on that the good people were saving Jews. And you had to be good, you had to save the Jews. So now they're trying to play it up that Pope Pius XII, by not interfering too much, did more to save the Jews than if he had. You know, they're pulling out all that and making it. And that's what they changed the Yad Vashem plaque to, which was just attacking Pope Paul and announcing all the things he did wrong. Now the Yad Vashem has backed away a little bit, changed their plaque, and added some ideas about that the Pope Pius defenders have about the good that he did in saving Jews. You know, it's all about saving Jews. And this is the problem. You know, the Catholic Church had been for so long one of our real bulwarks against the Judaization of Western society, but it has really broken. And you know who broke it? Pope John Paul. The Vatican first recognized Israel in 1993, and Pope John Paul II, isn't that the Polish Pope John Paul? I think so, because that's when he was Pope. He made an official visit to Israel in the year 2000. Okay, that's where it began. You know, I mean, they broke it. They said, well, we need to make amends here, or we need to come to an agreement. We need ecumenism and so on. And, he made a stop at Yad Vashem. I'm sure there are photographs of him in there with his little, could they have put one of those little beanie caps on the Pope? Oh, he wears his own. So maybe not, but he was in there, you know, looking at their eternal flame and so on. And now the current Pope, Benedict, he is just following along, with what's already been, what already was decided for the Catholic Church. So I don't say, well, he's that, you know, you blame him for going along with it, but I don't blame him for the whole thing because it already happened before he came along. But, that's the situation. There are the traditionalist Catholics still, and they're still good. But and then there is the Orthodox Christian Church, which is a bit stronger. But anyway, to get off of that, I will go on to this. Which should I do first? Well, since I'm talking about, we all know about the German court that ruled religious circumcision is bodily harm. So I'm not going to go over that. But in keeping with what I'm talking about, how the Jews take over everything in our country, in our society, in our environment, and turn it into something about them. Here's something that David Bailey sent me. It's actually from May. It's already taken place. It was May 20th, 2012. But it was a symposium put on about the Jewish role in reshaping the racial landscape of Southern California. It was put on by the UCLA Center for Jewish Studies, located, it was held at Hillel at UCLA. Naturally, it was free. You know, anybody could come. Probably was all Jews and Mexicans, because it was about, here's the description, rather than considering the history of Jewish activism from the perspective of organizations or communities, this symposium will examine the way that individual Jews have navigated the social terrain of Southern California in the 20th century, including the relationship between Jews and Mexican Americans in and around Los Angeles. So they're working on the Mexican Americans, of course, and they want to get everybody on their side. It was supported by three Jewish organizations, and with support from the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Endowment. And you know how these wealthy Jews leave endowments to universities, and then but they specify what they can be used for. So they're always used for promoting Jewish things. So they have a lot of that. And we also found that Anderson Cooper confirmed what most people already knew, that he is gay. He says, "The fact is, I'm gay." Well, that's no surprise, but now he's going to say how proud he is. All right, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned for the next hour, and I will be back with my guest, Friedrich Paul Berg. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. This is the second half of the Heretics Hour program on July 2nd. It will take me about a minute to connect with my guest, Friedrich Paul Berg of NaziGassings.com. In the meantime, I will tell you that the point that I want to make with this is that the Holocaust is vulnerable, and it's very important that we really move forward with Holocaust revisionism. Holocaust revisionism and Holocaust truth, if you want to put it that way, is so important, and we need to be working. We need to direct energy at that if we want to change the climate that is inexorably taking over in our world. Let's see, the value of debating the Holocaust. I wanted to talk with Mr. Berg about that. How meaningful is Cotto's, I don't want to bring up Cotto right now, but Cotto is a committee on open debate on the Holocaust. But the question that I've had is, what is the value of debating debate these days? Because what I notice is that there's very few who are willing to debate a revisionist, and when they do, they don't debate in good faith. They make too many concessions, and we make too many concessions to get court historians and believers to debate with us. Okay. All right. While I'm waiting on all of this, I will go back to what I didn't talk about. And I mentioned Anderson Cooper. I won't go into that anymore. But, you know, okay, it looks like all I have left, though, is some interesting stuff from Bill Bonner. Bill Bonner is a financial writer, but he's much more than that. He writes very well, and he sometimes brings up some very interesting things. And actually, he's such a good writer and so entertaining that he puts out this newsletter, and people who have financial stuff to sell pay him. So people pay him to put their stuff on there, and so he doesn't. He does sell his own financial stuff, but he doesn't have to write about that all the time. So he writes about some interesting things. And I just happened to go look at some of his columns just for myself, and some of them come to me in my email box, and so I was just looking at them before I deleted them, and I found some things I liked. So, you know, here's the point that fits in with tonight's program. Bill Bonner is an Irish Roman Catholic white man with a strong marriage, been married to the same woman from the beginning. They have five children who are grown up now, and some are just in their college still, and some are already out. And they've been very family-centered. He's made a lot of money. I'm not saying he hasn't made a lot of money, but why shouldn't good white people make money, not just the Jews making all the money? So I'm happy about that. But here's they used to live in France, but they moved back to the United States. But now he says they were visiting in France. And this article is entitled America's Number One Zombie Industry. And it is if you want to know, I'll tell you right now what the number one zombie industry is war, according to him. He's been talking about zombies a lot for the last few years, a couple of years anyway, or maybe 1 year. But anyway, he uses the word zombie for people who use stuff but don't produce anything. You know, they don't produce. And he says we've got more and more zombies in the world. An example of a zombie would be, you know, a welfare recipient that's on a permanent welfare, you know, permanently on the welfare rolls. That's a zombie. But also, big people, big corporations, big industry, bankers, and so on, newspaper editors and writers. They're also, some of these are also zombies. So here I'm just going to read this, start out, because it's all good. One of the advantages of moving overseas, he says, is that you see home more clearly. We came to France last week already America comes into clearer focus. I don't know if they moved there. I don't know. But anyway, they went there. And the French press seems fascinated, he says, by the relationship between François Hollande's two mistresses. Now, François Hollande is the man who just became prime minister of France. He's the socialist. He defeated Sarkozy, who was considered a conservative, and was part Jewish. But I don't like Hollande either. Bonner says the former of the mistresses, the former mistress, a candidate for president herself, dumped him when he took up with the latter. The former is also the mother of Hollande's four children, which complicates things further. So here's the thing. This new prime minister in France has his former mistress. He hasn't married them, I guess. He has his former mistress, and they broke up when she got mad when he took up with another woman, and so and she's now entered politics. But they have four children together. But now this new mistress, is the one he's with now, since the other one left him. And Bonner says the latter hates the former hates the latter. So this is all the talk now in France about the private life of their new prime minister. And as you know, probably the French kind of take pride in the fact that they are very sophisticated, and they do not have these Puritan ideas like Americans have, and they understand that people have affairs, and they don't mind. Their prime ministers and presidents have been having affairs and so on for a long, long time. You know, they don't mind. They find it interesting, I guess. And another thing, though, that we should remember is that France is the most racially is one of the most racially mixed European nations. It's kind of shameful. They have allowed that to happen. They've allowed it to become more and more non-white until they've got so much non-white there, and they defend it basically. The governments do. The government does, as being, well, everybody's French who's here, and this is the way it's going to be. So anyway, the Bonners are at dinner with this French couple. He says they've known them for years. They're charming people. And this is what they learned about this. They said this couple spent half the dinner telling us about the presidential ménage, and the other half was spent telling us about what they had eaten recently. They seemed to recall the details of every meal, how it was prepared, what mistakes the chef made, and what the weather must have been when the grapes were picked for their wine. Well, there you are. What he's implying there is that these people are caught up in their own pleasures, like so many French are, in food, and this is what is important to them, how well they eat, you know, how well their food is prepared and so on. And he says, as to the imminent financial catastrophe in Europe, they were sanguine, even blasé. And he quotes him as saying, every week we're told the end of Europe will arrive next week. Frankly, we don't care anymore. Now, Bill Bonner goes on, what Europeans care about is their vacations. Now, this is really interesting. He says, after decades of social and political struggle, the working classes of the old world won the right to at least 4 weeks of paid vacation. Now, let me interject here that the reason I think this is interesting, and hope it's interesting to you, is that these are our white European people, you know, and I am not one who wants to attack us and attack whites, but we have an awful lot of people like this who really don't care. They're just living for themselves, and this is kind of what this is all about. It is the liberalism in Europe, the idea that the European idea that they very much got into after World War II, that of social programs and lots of free time and leisure time, and nobody should have to work so hard because Europe had a lot of resources and they could set up societies where they could live the good life and still produce enough, and they can produce. But what they didn't take into consideration in this whole picture was all the immigration, which is supposedly brought in to, for all these people to do the work that needs to be done. But at the same time, they are using resources in welfare, all these welfare benefits. And they are also encouraging, this also encourages the native people, the real French people, the real German people, the real Spanish people, wherever you are, not to reproduce themselves, because these immigrants are reproducing so much and they're doing all the work. And so, and this has been encouraged by the Judaic thought structure, or the Judaic overlords that are behind so much of this. And so this has been a real deterioration of the rule of white people over their own nations. And this is what's going on here. Anyway, this story about the vacations. Bonner writes, after decades of social and political struggle, the working classes of the old world won the right to at least 4 weeks of paid vacation. Bosses could not stand in their way. And now Europe's highest court has ruled that even nature cannot be allowed to spoil a vacation. The New York Times writes about this, and he quotes from the New York Times, from a Dateline Brussels, for most Europeans, almost nothing is more prized than their 4 to 6 weeks of guaranteed annual vacation leave. Well, there's really nothing wrong with working people to have 4 to 6 weeks annual vacation a year, if your country was ruled in the way it should be. But Bonner goes on, the New York Times goes on, but it was not clear just how sacrosanct that time off was until Thursday, when Europe's highest court ruled that workers who happened to get sick on vacation were legally entitled to take another vacation. The purpose of entitlement to paid annual leave is to enable the worker to rest and enjoy a period of relaxation and leisure. The Court of Justice of the European Union, based in Luxembourg, ruled in a case involving department store workers in Spain. Quote, the purpose of entitlement to sick leave is different, since it enables a worker to recover from an illness that has caused him to be unfit for work, unquote. So the thing is, if you're taking your 4-week vacation, and during that time you should get sick, well, then your vacation time is suspended and you go on sick leave time. And you can be sick until you get well, until the doctor says you're well enough to return. When that happens, then you pick up again on your vacation time. So you don't lose any of that vacation time if you should become ill during your vacation. Pretty nice. But this is probably not the way it's done in any of the plans here in the United States, but this is how it's done in France and maybe a lot of other places in Europe too. So you see, things in France are as they should be. People are delusional, but not deadly. Yeah, well, it's not deadly, but it's a little bit delusional. Now, then he goes on to talk about the United States of America. He says an ill wind is blowing here. The president is a portrait of failure and homicide. He has brought up before about Barack Obama's, that he likes to pick out the targets for the drones. he does that personally. He's talked about that. But here he doesn't exactly go into that. He does a little bit. But he says the president is a portrait of failure and homicide. As far as we know, he doesn't even have one mistress, which is probably why he has so much time on his hands. According to the New York Times, he personally approves the list of, he personally approves the list of unfortunates his drones will assassinate. And for what? Well, then he quotes from Philip Giraldi's article or column by him entitled Terrorism Arithmetic. And this is pretty interesting. Giraldi writes, only 3 American citizens were kidnapped by overseas terrorists in 2011 in Somalia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, all of which were war zones, and only 17 were killed in foreign lands, 15 in Afghanistan, a war zone. And then he says that the number of Americans killed in terrorist attacks is comparable to to the number crushed to death by falling television sets or furniture each year. All right, there's no Americans being killed in war zones, or by terrorist attacks, I should say. There's no Americans killed in terrorist attacks at all. There's a certain number, not that many, who are killed in war zones, naturally. So now, he says, but every president wants to be a war president. War is America's number one zombie industry. And now here we go into the numbers. The federal government, this comes from Giraldi, I do believe, the federal government employs 2,100,000 today, compared to 1.5 million in 2001. So in 11 years, it has gone up by over a third of government employees, not including the military. This doesn't even include the military, which has itself grown by 100,000 and is today at 2,300,000. So we've got 2,100,000 today in the federal government employees, and then also 2,300,000 employees in the military, which includes the reserves. But there are more increases planned through 2013, so this is not the end of this number. But he says most of the new hires were directly related to the war on terror. For manning, get this, the 200 new military and CIA bases that have sprung up around the world, 200 new ones, and to serve as Fortress America's defenders. The number of reported federal employees, this 2,100,000 number, does not include contractors who add considerably to the payroll. So they're not in the military, and they're not in the federal government number either, and there's a lot of contractors. It says more than half of the employees in key sectors within the intelligence community and at the Defense Department are contractors. Okay, half the employees within the intelligence community and Defense Department are contractors. You know, Gordon Duff says he is a military contractor. He's a Defense Department contractor. He also says he's in intelligence. He's also said he used to be in intelligence, or he was, and he implies that he still is and gets all this intelligence information that nobody else has, but he never really knows anything that anybody else doesn't know. So I don't believe him, but this is what he says. And then he writes Veterans Today and acts like he's a truth teller, while at the same time he says he's a defense contractor for the United States. Oh, he might be on their list of the number that they have. Bonner says, asks, what does it cost to keep these zombies fed? And Giraldi offers some answers. He says that Uncle Sam will spend $3.796 trillion in 2012, compared with $1.863 trillion that they spent in 2001. So what happened in 2001? 9/11 happened. And so that's when it all started growing because of the war on terror. All right, and it went from 1.86 trillion to in 11 years, I guess it is now almost, not quite, 3.79 million. That is more than double. No, it's not. It's a little bit less than double. Sorry about that. But that's a huge jump of money that's being spent. Now, it says that there is a full-time security manning the entrances of nearly all federal and state and even some local office buildings. Okay, all of our government buildings, in a sense, you know, have to have full-time security manning. That must cost a little bit right there. And even local office buildings. I'm not where I live, for sure, but in probably a lot of places, they feel that that's necessary. The total costs of state and local expenditures to counter the essentially bogus terrorist threat might well exceed the federal expenditures. And then there is the spending on security, often mandated by the government, in the private sector. But as bad as all those numbers are, consider for a moment the legacy costs and institutional damages that are not so readily visible. Professor Joseph Stiglitz of Columbia University estimates that Iraq will cost as much as $5 trillion when all the costs are figured in, including the interest paid on borrowed money and medical treatment, which is necessary for life for the tens of thousands of wounded soldiers, when all that is paid off. Well, we've heard all that before. I know that, $5 trillion. But, you know, in the beginning it was supposed to be cheap, oh, a couple billion or something, and then we'd have won and changed the world and brought peace and defeated terrorism, blah, blah, blah. This is worse than the promise that of World War One to keep the world safe for democracy or something. No, that was the war to end all wars. World War One was the war to end all wars. And then right away they started World War II. It wasn't Hitler that started it, friends. He wasn't the one that wanted it. So World War II was the war to make the world safe for democracy. And now we find what democracy is bringing us. They're still making the world, pushing democracy around the world. And that's what all these new wars are about. And all this huge amount of money, and $5 trillion is just for Iraq. That's not for Afghanistan. He says the bill for Afghanistan will be proportionate depending on how long the U.S. stays there and at what commitment level. So it's all a deep, dark hole. And there we are. All right, so another Bonner article that I really thought was super interesting because it's about Obamacare. And he titles it, Now Tyranny's Called a Tax. And, again, this is 3 days after he wrote the last one. It's now June 29th, just a couple days ago. And he says, 4 days ago, I guess. And he writes, the U.S. seems to have gotten the worst of it, said a French friend. A French friend told him this. This is what he was saying about the United States, this Frenchman. He says, now that the Supreme Court has approved Obamacare, you have the same problems we have in Europe, social welfare spending with no limits, plus you have your colossal military spending. You have both bread and circuses, just like the ancient Romans. You are doomed. And Bill Bonner writes, yes, dear reader, we came to the fork in the road after the 9/11 attack and took it. I like that line. We came to the fork in the road and we took the wrong road, really. And now the feds can fork over whoever and whatever they want. No kidding. They just have to think of it as a tax. He says, here's the AP's report on yesterday's decision. Healthcare law survives with Robert's help. And it's writing that America's historic healthcare overhaul will now certainly touch every citizen's life, and it survived in an election year battle at the Supreme Court Thursday with the improbable help of conservative Chief Justice John Roberts. But the ruling, by a 5-4 vote, also gave Republicans unexpected ammunition to energize supporters for the fall campaign against President Barack Obama's, look here, Friedrich Berg is calling. Let me try to bring him on. I guess his wife got hold of him, maybe. Let's see, I go over here. Hey. Hello, Fritz, are you there? I got to get to the...
Yes, Carolyn?
Yes, there you are.
Okay.
All right, well, we're making noise now. Okay. Brother.
That's not the right connection yet?
No, yes, it is. It is. So, okay, now we can continue with our program if we still have listeners. What do you know? Amazing. They want to hear what you have to say. Okay, you were telling us about how you got started, but let's try to go through that pretty quick.
Well, as an engineer, I recognized a major flaw in the Holocaust story, which was that 2 million Jews were supposedly killed with diesel exhausts. And that is absurd because diesel exhaust smells bad and looks bad, but it's generally very, very non-toxic. If you want to kill people with diesel exhaust, you can do it, but it's very hard. It really makes no sense as a method for generating carbon monoxide or anything to kill people. And for 30 years, I've been the man who's been making that point. Finally, now, in the last few years, some of the leading German scholars admit that at least on that particular point, we revisionists are absolutely right. No one was killed with diesel exhaust. Now, that's a major, major victory, in a sense, for Holocaust revisionism, because diesel exhaust was the big tool for mass murder, according to all of the leading Holocaust scholars. John Demjanjuk supposedly murdered 800,000 people with diesel exhaust, and it's simply an absurd, false claim. And that was a major part of my research, at least for the early years. I've also shown that the alternative theory, which is that gasoline engine was used instead, is also absurd, because if you kill people with gasoline engine exhaust, you're going to be killing them with carbon monoxide, and the corpses will be bright cherry red with, in almost all cases. And what is important about that is that all of the self-described eyewitnesses to mass murder with carbon monoxide consistently claimed that the corpses were either blue or unremarkable, that they showed no signs of any unusual coloring, according to the self-described eyewitnesses. The fact is, corpses of people who've been killed with carbon monoxide are bright cherry red, and everyone who isn't colorblind can see that very, very easily and quickly. You do not have to be a medical doctor to recognize that. Anybody with normal vision can see that. One of Muhlenkamp's weaknesses, as far as the debate was concerned, is that I think he really is colorblind. Otherwise, he would have not made the kind of really stupid remarks that he was making.
I don't think he can be colorblind. They just refuse to face the facts and think that they can say something different and people won't know. They try to fool people who aren't going to look into it. And this is what we want to get at, is that this debating with these people. But another point is that now here you're making progress with this. This is the kind of thing that has to be pushed so hard, but it's like other things, like say 9/11. There's so many parts to it. So many aspects that as soon as you try to make progress and prove something in one area, they'll go off into another area and bring distractions in and so on. And then it's like you have to prove everything about all of it all at the same time, or you haven't done anything. And this is the kind of thing we have to come up with a strategy for this, don't you think?
Well, I agree. We have to make our case strong and simple so that the average person can grasp what we're saying very, very quickly. The attention span of most people is limited. There are books on the Holocaust that are huge books. William Shirer's book, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, is 1,200 pages. There are other books that are 500 pages, 600 pages, 700 pages. I know when people use that much paper to make their point, they've failed, because no one reads books like that. But a few powerful, simple arguments undermine the entire Holocaust story. For example, there are no autopsies to show that even one person in any concentration camp was ever killed with poison gas of any sort, cyanide or carbon monoxide. No autopsies.
Well, how many autopsies are there?
Well, there were at least 1,000 autopsies made by one pathologist already. His name was Larson. And we have information about his autopsies from him. And it clearly showed that he could not find even one specimen of a person who died from poison gas or poison of any sort. The British, I'm sure, conducted their own autopsies at Bergen-Belsen and came up with nothing. The Russians claimed there were some autopsies made in connection with the gas vans, but not in connection with Auschwitz or any of the other camps. They didn't even claim to have made autopsies. So as far as serious evidence to support the gassing claims, it's just not really there. Another simple fact, there are no photographs that anyone seriously contends are photographs of people killed in gas chambers. They show lots and lots of pictures of dead people or sick people or unhappy people in the concentration camps at the end of the war. None of those pictures are pictures of people who were killed in gas chambers. And the people who present these pictures do not even claim that these people were killed in gas chambers. They know perfectly well that they have no even remotely good evidence that anyone was killed in gas chambers. All they have, and this is it, all they have are the lying statements of various types of witnesses who, for one reason or another, lied their heads off, whether they were lying about the Axion Reinhardt camps or Auschwitz. That kind of evidence.
Well, yeah, I was talking about that in the first hour. I'm glad I did, about all these silly survivor stories. Well, let's move on in the few minutes that we have to then how to get these debates going. You got a debate going with Roberta Muhlenkamp a week ago last Friday, and you can tell people where they can listen to it, but I bet very few people, when you think of all the people who should listen to it, it needs to be put someplace where it's easily accessed, and you
website.
Take all the yeah.
The link to the entire debate is on my website.
Yeah, but what would be better would be one that had all the commercials taken out and
it
was
is
just
the
oh, is it okay? Oh, all right, good, Well, now they're talking about debates. Then NaziGassings.com, people can go there and look for that debate and hear how Fritz talks, and then hear how this Muhlenkamp talks, and try to get a feel for how they just shift things all around and don't really say anything. But now you were saying to me that where debates can be done, because you say, well, we can debate on forums and discussion groups. That's about it, isn't it? I mean, and a lot of these places, then they ban revisionists when they start talking about that. It's
right, exactly. Well, that's the way the world is. Google controls much of the internet today. We used to have news groups that were wide open. You could use curse words and say almost anything about your opponent and whatever, and those were very useful discussion forums. And then Google took over, and I can't get into any of those news groups anymore. Germany is completely controlled. All the news groups, discussion forums in Germany are totally censored, and people like myself are blocked completely. So there is a real struggle just to get a revisionist message out to any kind of an audience. But the world is changing. We can put stuff on YouTube, and of course we have your program and other programs. So we are making progress, but it's a very slow process. One interesting thing is that these scholars, the so-called scholars, now dare not simply ignore the revisionists. I just got about a week ago a major book from Germany, NS Mass Murders with Poison Gas. It's an extension or a successor to a previous book from more than 20 years ago by 34 scholars. This book has like 50 scholars, including Robert Van Pelt and Richard Evans, as well as many leading German scholars. And the book already in the subtitle admits that it is directed against Holocaust denial, okay? 30 years ago, they wouldn't even acknowledge that there was such a thing as Holocaust denial. But today, they know Holocaust deniers like me are out there, and we're not rolling
over. See, I didn't know that. I thought that back then we were doing better, and they were discussing things with revisionists and so on. But you're saying different. You're saying that they're just starting to have to acknowledge us in more recent times. Well, that's good then.
That's real progress. It's an admission that they have a problem, and they're trying to answer it by actually discussing publicly the revisionist works and arguments. They're doing a terrible job because they're simply wrong. Their arguments are essentially rubbish. And that becomes clear when one really pursues these things. So the Muhlenkamp debate was an important step in the right direction. It doesn't solve everything, far from it. There will have to be many more debates. I encourage everybody to debate wherever he can, even if it's in one's own little...
Well, that's right, but then, we don't have too much time. I want to bring up that we did agree that probably videos and documentaries are the best way to go now. We should do more work along those lines, because people do watch these videos, but they're not even want to listen to a whole radio program about it. It's really a shame, because I think you get more from listening than from looking at something. But
it all depends on the type of evidence. The photographs of victims of carbon monoxide poisoning are stunning photographs. When you look at pictures, as I have provided on my website, including right in the logo of my website, I have a picture of a dead body of someone who died from carbon monoxide. The colors, the bright cherry red coloring, is stunning. It's unforgettable.
Yes, it is. It is. But you know what they'll say? They say, well, they really wasn't carbon monoxide. No, it was something else, and that was this, and that was that. Well, that doesn't matter. What about here? They just shift it all around. You know, if this thing is wrong, well, a bunch of other stuff is right. So you know, you're still guilty, kind of.
Well, of course they will try to do that, but with certain types of evidence, they simply cannot get away from the hard reality. And the hard reality is that all of the self-described witnesses, and there are only about a dozen who've testified in various court cases under oath as to what they saw and all that, and how the gas chambers supposedly worked, and those things are on record, and it's not the sort of thing they can simply ignore and wiggle around indefinitely.
Okay. Well, what do you think are the strongest arguments? You already said this.
There are a whole bunch of them, but one of the best is there are no autopsies. You can look all you want in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, archives, wherever. There are no autopsies that show anyone was ever killed with poison gas. The diesel exhaust hoax is important. This is enormously important. This is a major crack in the Holocaust mythology. The cherry red appearance of corpses with carbon monoxide totally undermines all of the carbon monoxide eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. Other things are the simple fact that Germany was actually using poison gas to drive its entire civilian economy. Poison gas was all over the place, but it would have involved a different technology for mass murder than what's alleged. For the camps like Treblinka and Baltic Sabor, it wouldn't have been the exhaust from the gasoline engines that would have been toxic. It would have been the fuel itself that was many, many times more toxic than the exhaust. So there are all kinds of absurdities. Now, different people read things differently. Technical arguments only work with people who are sort of comfortable with technology. A lot of people, most people, don't even know the difference between a diesel engine and a gasoline engine. So most of what I've had to say over the last 30 years just goes right past them. But some things register with some people, some things register with other people. So it's a struggle. But the evidence is on our side. Now, one enormously important piece of evidence is the testimony from Holocaust survivors. You can do a simple search on YouTube and you get the stories of Holocaust survivors who were kept alive by the Nazis, who weren't gassed or killed at all, even though they were in German custody, under German control for many months, sometimes even years, and they were not killed. They were clearly fed by the Nazis. They were given clothing. They were given medical care. They were given shelter. They were given security. They were kept alive by the Nazis. Why would the Nazis have kept all these people alive, these hundreds of thousands that are just in Israel, 200,000 just in Israel, according to the most recent story? Why would the Nazis have kept them alive if they were out to exterminate all the Jews? It just flies in the face of common sense.
Well, don't you think we need more workers? I want to encourage people to get involved. I mean, there's people who are interested. They read what you write, what you say on forums, what other people say and do. You know, they read my Elie Wiesel site, but they don't. Well, I guess they do talk to other people, but it would be good if we had more people join in this. You know, we've got we're down to going on 30 seconds left, Fritz. So I want to thank you. I want to apologize to the listeners for all the trouble we had. I'm just going to have to maybe not do all these live shows in order to make things work better. But sorry our time was cut so short, but thank you very much for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we've got 30 seconds. You have a few more. Want to say a little bit more?
My website, please, www.naziguessings.com. On the homepage already, it's a big homepage. I give all the arguments that I think are especially important. And the visual graphic evidence is stunning.
Yeah, it is stunning. People should go there. Please go there, ladies and gentlemen. And please take Holocaust revisionism seriously. It's very important. It's not something that can be ignored. It's crucial to our struggle. Good night, everyone, and see you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.